Good morning, everyone. If you would, grab a Bible. Let's turn together to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 24, please. Acts 24. We'll be studying from this part of the Bible, and we'll be moving around a little bit in that part of Acts, but it'll help you to have a Bible or something on a device that takes you to Bible passages open to that place. Acts chapter 24. Thank you so much for being here this morning, and I appreciate so much everyone joining in the worship of our God. It's been a good morning, and it is good to be with you, good to be before you. Appreciate especially those who are visiting with us who we don't know, and you may not know us or know anyone here, but we want you to know that we want to know you, and we want you to feel at peace and at home here among the people of God. It says a lot about you that you have the courage to be here this morning and that you have chosen of all the things you could be doing to come worship God, and we just want you to feel welcome among us, and especially if there's some need that you have, something that we can do for you, especially to help you draw closer to God or know more about His Word, please let us help you in that. Thank you for your presence this morning. Acts 24, let's start in verse 24. Acts 24, 24. It says, "After some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, 'Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you.' At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul, so he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison." Sometimes we read the scriptures to find great people to emulate. So we see great men and women who are commended by God, Moses or Daniel, and we try to say, what were their qualities? What things did they do? How can I be like them? But at other times, scriptures give us examples of people not to be like, people that we want to avoid being. So we find men and women who made tremendous mistakes or were condemned by God for their attitudes and their actions. And this morning, we're going to focus on one of the latter group. I want us to talk about an example of someone, a man who we don't want to be like. I just want to talk this morning about how we cannot be a Felix. The book of Acts is a book that really is the story of how people react to the gospel. On one level, it's the story of how the Spirit continues the work of Jesus after he has ascended to heaven, how he works through the apostles, and how all of these interesting new scenes develop as God is at work, how the gospel spreads from this small place out into the broader world. And you see its encounter with different people. You see peasants, you see kings, you see everyone in between faced with the gospel message. And some of them respond really well. They immediately obey. They say, yes, I want to do that. I believe in this. I want to be a part of this. And then there are others who do not respond well. And there is a gamut of reactions from stoning and hissing to maybe even keeping someone in prison because they don't say the things you'd like for them to say. And so Felix fits in that latter group, those who reject the gospel and the message. And yet Felix has a number of opportunities to hear about Jesus, and he continues to reject him. When the curtain closes on Felix, as we see at the end of the chapter, for one reason or another, he is chosen to reject the good news about Jesus. So the message this morning is really simple. Don't be a Felix, okay? Let's talk about what that means. Who is Felix? Felix was a Roman who was governor over Judea. There is a very famous, probably better known, Roman governor over Judea named Pontius Pilate, who was governor during the time when Jesus was crucified. And so he, like Felix, had a hard job and didn't do great at it. Felix was a man who had been a slave, but was freed due to his brother's connections in Rome. And so, as a result of those connections, he was also given this post where he is governor in Judea. He was known as a particularly brutal governor. We know from Tacitus, who wrote about Felix, he, quote, "practiced every kind of cruelty and lust, wielding the power of a king with the instincts of a slave." You can just take of that what you will, but Tacitus, not high on Felix. It was a tumultuous time in this area, as you know if you are familiar with the book of Acts. There were a lot of revolutionaries going around, a lot of would-be messiahs. And you can just imagine, if you are governor and a foreigner in Judea, it's going to be a hard thing to keep the peace. And you can just imagine how, as time goes by, you think, you know what, I just need to have a firmer and firmer hand. And that's what Felix did, to the point that he was known for his cruelty, as Tacitus has said. We also know about Felix that he falls in love with a woman. It mentions in verse 24, his wife Drusilla, when she was married to another man. She was married to the king of Emesa. He wooed her and convinced her to come marry him. And now she has become the queen, or at least the governor's wife, here in this role in Judea. Now he is going to factor into our story, into the gospel story, because of his interactions with Paul. So let's talk about Paul, because at this point, Paul has been accused by the Jews of bringing a Gentile into the temple. And so they have seized him, and they have sort of followed him around to get him into trouble. He has been passed around like a hot potato to the different jurisdictions of this area, and ultimately, he gets to Felix. So if you back up to chapter 23 of Acts, Acts 23 and verse 33, and just remember, as you read this, that when you see the word governor, you're going to hear about Felix. That's who we're thinking of. Acts 23, 33, when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. When he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So he agrees to hear the case. Chapter 24 and verse 1 says, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. Time out. You can laugh at that. That is terrible misinformation. It is the buttering up that we would do to an insecure ruler who needs to hear, yeah, you're doing a great job. We sure do love you. Now please vote for us. Verse 3, in every way and in everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man, speaking of Paul, a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the charge, affirming that all these things were so. So they come down to Caesarea to accuse Paul, and they flatter Felix with some things that are patently untrue. They accuse Paul of stirring up riots wherever he goes. Now, you could take that accusation for what you will. Does Paul stir up riots? Maybe a little. Okay, I don't know that Paul is doing the stirring up, but Paul certainly has some ideas that frustrate his fellow Jews. They also accuse him of profaning the temple, which is a charge he's going to deny. But just imagine, if you're Felix, you don't care so much about the religious debates, right? You don't care if that, oh, you profaned the temple, whatever. Okay, I don't care about that. I just want the people to be calm. So if this guy is an agitator, maybe we need to deal with him. So verse 10, and when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Can you just take a time out and notice the difference in the way Paul addresses Felix and the way the spokesman for the Jews does? Spokesman for the Jews lays it on pretty thick, and he says, well, I know you've been governor a while. Not much flattery there, okay? So here's Paul. He's going to make his defense. Verse 11, you can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. And they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation, should they have anything against me. Or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it's with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day. So Paul denies all the charges except one. He does say, I do have a confession to make. Verse 14, this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and the prophets. He said, yeah, I'll cop to that. I do worship God according to what they call a sect. I do believe in the same God they do. I do believe in the promises that that God made in the law and the prophets. And I do worship him with a clear conscience to this day. He says, hey, nobody is proving anything against me. The people who they say caught me in the temple are not even here. They should have come down. If this was such a terrible crime, why are they not here to testify? And so Paul is just point by point refuting the case. So Felix has the facts laid out before him. Just imagine, you're Felix, you're the governor, and the facts are there are no witnesses of the crime. No one can say he stirs up riots. There's really nothing here. It's open and shut. So verse 22, but Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case. So Felix, it says, has a rather accurate or a more accurate knowledge of the way. He knows better than this. When it says the way, by the way, that is describing the Christian movement, what they have called a sect. And he says he knows that, and he knows better than these charges that are being made against Paul. He knows enough to know that the accusations don't fit the truth, that this is not a revolutionary group, that Paul's not going around starting riots and trying to overthrow the government or something like that. But instead of dismissing the charges in verse 22, Felix punts. So you know what? Let's wait till we get more information. Let's let the tribune come down and testify. I mean, what's he going to say? Yeah, I found him in the temple. Okay, but that's what he's doing. It's making a procedural punt. Verse 23, then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody, but have some liberty, and that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. So it's pretty clear there by some of the freedoms he gives Paul that he doesn't really think Paul is guilty or have any concern about anything that's going to happen while he's there in his custody. Verse 24, after some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. And he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you. At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul. So he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So Felix comes to hear Paul speak now. This is not a defense of Paul's actions. He's listening to him speak about the way, about Jesus, about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. And Felix is afraid. He says, go away, Paul, come back later. And he does. Even later, they keep having these meetings. He's hoping for a bribe, the text says, which never comes. And so at the end of it all, Felix leaves Paul in prison and exits stage right, and we don't hear from him again. This was Felix's opportunity, in fact, series of opportunities. Felix has so many chances to do the right thing, to believe Paul, to rule justly, to accept the gospel, to let Paul go, and he rejects them all. And so the question is, why? Why? And that's what I want to talk about for the balance of our time. Why did Felix not do the right thing? Why did Felix not accept the message that he clearly had some affinity for? Why? And I want to suggest three reasons from the text here. First, Felix rejected the gospel for political reasons. That is the question, what will people think? Political reasons. So look back in verse 22. In chapter 24, verse 22, it says, Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case. Then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody, but have some liberty that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. So he knows the way better than these Jews who have come, but I want you to think about the pressure of this moment. You've got a delegation of Jewish people. Remember, you are governor of the Jewish people, and here they are. They're hot, and you've got one guy over here who's saying, no, these charges are unfounded. So Felix has to consider not only who's right, he also is considering, how is this going to play? If I rule for Paul, what are these guys going to say? What are they going to go back to Jerusalem and say? What's the word on the street about me going to be if I make them mad? So look down a little further in chapter 24. Look in verse 27. It says, when 2 years had elapsed, so no more, you know, delegation hanging around. We're 2 years later. Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. Why is Felix so concerned about the Jews? Well, we actually know this from secular history. The Jews were so unhappy with Felix's terrible rule that they went to Rome and asked for him to be removed. They were tired of him. Josephus says that he would have been punished if not for his brother in Rome, who had those connections we talked about earlier, pulling some strings for him. So just think about that. You can feel the pressure there, right? You're trying to keep the peace. You're doing a bad job. The people you're ruling are mad. They're going to go over your head to get you kicked out. So what are you going to do? Paul versus them? Do the right thing or do the thing that helps you keep your job? That's a hard situation, isn't it? And that's why, at least in one reason, why Felix falls. I want you to consider that's the nature of the Roman politician, really the politician of any era. He's concerned with, what will my constituents think? How will this play? What will it sound like with the people back home? And oh yeah, he has a job to do, but kind of complicates the job. What will people think? It is not a climate for truth seeking. Who cares about the truth? We care about whether people are going to stay happy with us. That's what we're concerned about. And Felix's dilemma, I hope you hear how it's related to a dilemma that we all face. The dilemma is that the right thing and the popular thing are not always the same thing, and that sometimes we must choose. We must choose even when people will think worse of us because we do what's right. Don't be a Felix. Don't only make your decisions based on what other people think. Decisions like, if I do this, what will my parents say? What will my friends think? Will I get criticized online or canceled, as we say? What if my coworkers find out? Might I lose my job if I do this? That's not to say that some of those relationships can't sometimes be an encouragement to do what's right. That sometimes our parents are encouraging us, yes, do the right thing. Or our friends are saying, yes, do this. Or there's some pressure that we get in a positive direction. It is to say that sometimes doing the right thing is going to make other people mad, and that we have to have the courage to do the right thing anyway. Do you know why Pilate, his name became a byword among us? It's because he had a chance to do the right thing and he faltered under the pressure. Felix is the same way, although he's a little lesser known. He has a chance, and yet he is too weak to do it. Now, I don't say that simply to criticize. I don't know how I would react in this situation. I do know myself. I do know my tendency, which is, this is Jacob speaking, which is I tend to be very aware and very concerned about what other people think about my decisions, to the point that sometimes it leads me or pressures me to make decisions that I don't think are right just because I want people to remain happy with me. And yet, even as I say that, I think you can hear the weakness in that and the failure that that can produce. People and their influence are powerful. And we need to acknowledge that that can be negative. It can keep us from doing right. It can keep us from accepting the gospel. As I read this, there is a scene that keeps coming into my mind, which is the scene when Jesus is confronted by the temple authorities. Jesus has just cleansed the temple, and they come to him and they say, by what authority do you do this? And Jesus says, you answer my question and I'll answer your question. And he says, the baptism of John. Was John's baptism from heaven or from men? And do you remember what they do? I always picture them in a huddle. They all huddle up. All right, guys, what are we going to say? What are we going to say? And someone says, well, if we say from heaven, what's he going to say? Oh, he's going to come back with, but you didn't believe him. That won't go well. Okay, well, what if we say he's from men? They say, how will that play? Well, it'll mean the crowds are mad because they all believe he's a prophet. They're going to say that we're not telling the truth. So what do they say? Do you remember? They say, we don't know. We don't know. Which is as lame gets. We don't know. But I want you to hear, as they're reasoning through that, they are thinking politically. Okay, they're not saying, well, what's the truth? Was John's baptism from heaven or from men? Here's what I believe. This is what's right. They are saying, no, this is what everyone will be okay with us saying. This is what's going to win us the argument. This is what's going to keep us popular. And when we have a heart that's only concerned about what other people think, we lose a sense of the honesty that allows us to respond to God's truth accurately. And so we are too weak. We become like Felix. Paul writes, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God?" I'm trying to work this little red dot now. "Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Do you notice that he says, if I were still trying to please man? If I were still trying? There was a time in Paul's life where he lived that way. That's what that word implies. And yet when he came to Christ, he said, no more people pleasing. I am following Jesus now. And if somebody else doesn't like it, they're going to have to deal with it because I'm serving Jesus. And Paul lived that, even though it meant a change for him. And in the same way, we may have to change so that we say no more what will people think, but what does God want me to do? Second, Felix rejected the gospel for financial reasons. That is, he asked the question, what will this cost me? I want you to notice there is a financial thread through here. Look back in verse 17 of chapter 24. In verse 17, Paul mentions kind of in passing, "Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings." And I just want you to think about how a Roman governor might hear that. His ears might perk up. Oh, alms, huh? In other words, Paul has access to money. And he may not hear, oh, well, this is the collection of a bunch of different churches that have sent me here to send this, to give this money to to Jewish Christians. I'm not sure Felix would even care about where the money came from. He might just be seeing green here. In verse 23, it also says that Felix allowed Paul to have friends that attended to his needs. He assumes that Paul has friends who are going to take care of him indefinitely. Okay, money. People are going to be able to help him. And then, verse 26, chapter 24, verse 26, "At the same time, Felix hoped that money would be given him by Paul." So there it is in plain sight. Now the little undercurrent that's been playing around now comes out. This is what he was hoping for. Historical records show that that was a really common practice back then. But we're not told if he actually requested money or if he just kind of expected that it would be offered somehow, a bribe under the table. But somehow or another, he got the impression that Paul would be a perfect candidate for a bribe. And maybe even if he got that bribe, maybe the trial could move along a little bit. Maybe, in fact, I would be willing to cross the Jews if the price was right. But all of this just says, maybe Felix is not giving the gospel the hearing he otherwise would give it. Can you just imagine? What kind of gospel hearing comes when we're concerned about money? When we want the person who's trying to preach us the gospel to pay us? Don't you see? It's going to corrupt the whole process. In fact, it says that he kept asking him to come. Verse 26, he sent for him often and conversed with him. But that kind of changes the nature of that, right? It's not like, hey, can we keep having this Bible study? It's more like a shakedown. Hey, anybody bring you anything this week, Paul? You know, you had any visitors lately? It kind of changes the tone, doesn't it? That's kind of what money does. That when money gets involved in our calculations and our thinking about spiritual things, it becomes an issue. There are very often financial repercussions to gospel choices. Financial repercussions to to gospel choices. If I do this, will I lose my job? Will I have to share my money with other people? Will I have to make different financial choices, rearrange my life, rearrange my entertainment, rearrange my retirement plans, try to do something for someone else? Is it gonna hit me in the wallet? Turn back a page or two to Acts 19. Acts 19. Acts 19 and verse 18, speaking of some Christians in Ephesus, it says, Acts 19, 18, also many of those who were now believers came, confessing and divulging their practices, and a number of those who had practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all, and they counted the value of them and found it came to 50,000 pieces of silver. So the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. So notice that when some of these Gentiles become Christians, they burn their books, particularly their magic books, which is an incredible gesture. It means no matter what, I can't go back and do that again. That part of my life is over. That chapter's closed. I burned the bridge. It's over. But also it says that they counted the value of them as 50,000 pieces of silver, which kind of puts a different wrinkle on it, doesn't it? It says, wow, this was not just saying I don't want to go back to that life. It's also saying the money I spent on that, everything I devoted and sunk into that, I'm just going to say no more. It is a financial loss. Tremendous. Think about it. Could they have sold those books and recouped some of their money? Of course they could have. But then you're selling someone magic books so they can do it. You see, there's no good solution here but to say this money is gone. And they do. Financial repercussions to gospel decisions. Very often, the gospel costs people money. Matthew walks away from a lucrative job at the tax office. Peter, Andrew, James, and John leave behind their nets and boats and fishing business. The rich young ruler is challenged to sell all that he has and give it to the poor. Zacchaeus says, I will give away half my goods. The first Christians sold their possessions and gave them to one another. This is a tangible way we measure. Am I willing to do what's right? We can say it, but what does the bottom line show? What are we willing to do? I also think it's important to say that when Jesus calls his people to him and he challenges them about money, he does not say, hey, everybody, give me all your money. That Jesus is saying, I want it. It's for me. As if Jesus is going to get rich. That's not the nature of the gospel regarding money. That some one person is trying to fleece us. It is instead Jesus always challenging his people to whether or not money is going to be their God. Are you going to serve God and money? Because it won't work. No one can serve two masters. So there comes a time where we have to say, you know what? What's right is more important than how much it costs me. So I don't know exactly what application that might have in your heart today. But I do want you to consider that money considerations are not nearly as important as the will of God. That it might mean that you need to think and talk and make decisions differently than the world would, where it's not just about how much am I going to make if I take this job, but instead about what are the implications for me and my faith. Questions like, what would I be willing to sacrifice, to give up for that money? As if making more and doing better justifies whatever we have to do to get there. To consider, just how much a hold does this have on me? Am I willing to share and give with others, even when it might hurt, like first century Christians did? Or is this something that I care too much about? Don't be a Felix who says, you know what, I like some of this, I'm okay with some of it, but not if it's going to cost me. Third, Felix rejected the gospel for personal reasons, which is to ask the question, what will I have to change? Look in verse 24 of Acts 24. Let's go back there. Acts 24, verse 24. It says, after some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. Acts 24, 25. And as he reasoned about righteousness, and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, "Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you." These little hearings are very interesting to me. There's no new information about Paul's case. It's not as if he said, "Oh, let's have another hearing." It's no, let's talk about some other stuff. Let's talk about spiritual things. But he is present in verse 24 with the wife that he lusted after and connived away from her husband. She's there as a physical symbol of the lack of self-control present in Felix. There she is. She's sitting there as Paul has the guts to reason with Felix about self-control and righteousness of the judgment to come. So let's think about that. Three topics Luke points out in verse 25. Righteousness. Righteousness is just the idea of living by a standard, that there's something that's right and good. And when we live by that standard, we are righteous. And when we fall short of that standard, we are unrighteous. It implies that someone else or something else will direct my actions, something besides me. I'm not in charge. I am instead subject to a standard. And it is not about what's convenient for me or what seems right to me in the moment. It is instead about a righteous standard. Self-control is the second topic in verse 25. Self-control is the idea that I have to limit myself, that I don't get to do whatever I want. I can't just have whatever I want when I want it. Some things are off limits, like, for example, someone else's wife. I hope you hear how the gospel gets really personal. I hope you hear how that's a challenge, a shot across the bow for Felix. Judgment to come, or my version says the coming judgment. This is the idea that I will answer for my actions. Felix knew about this. He did what most of us have. He had job performance reviews. His were with a maybe less forgiving boss than some of ours, which was Caesar. And if Caesar ever didn't like something, guess what? You were judged. He knew about that, but that's not what Paul's talking about. The judgment to come is the idea that there is a higher power who will call me to account, and everything I've done will be laid before him, and he will decide, have I lived up to what he expects of me or not? I want you to hear how all of those represent significant changes for Felix. Different. A different way of living, a different way of thinking. In verse 25, it says that Felix was alarmed, or yours might say frightened or afraid, or some of them even say he trembled. And I just want you to imagine being in that moment. I want you to watch him as the wheels start turning, and he's thinking about the job he has and the pressure he's under and the wife he has and the prisoner who's before him, and about the God he must believe in, and think, oh no, what if he's going to see everything I've done and call me to account? And he begins to reason through that and think through that. And in the pressure of that moment, what does he do? He opts out. Verse 25, go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I'll summon you. I've heard preachers say that Felix never had another opportunity. I've heard that. In fact, I've heard it several times in my younger years. That's not true at all. He had a bunch of opportunities. It says that he conversed often. But I do think probably none of those later meetings had the same intensity of that moment. Do you know there are moments in our lives, brothers and sisters, where we face things and we see it with clarity and we know a change needs to happen, and yet when we say no in that moment, later on it may not be quite as intense, and we find it easier to say no again and again and again. I think that's what happened with Felix. The change seemed like too much. What will I have to change? Will I change my way of talking? Change my penchant for getting angry with everyone? Let go of some hurts people have done to me? I think it's pretty clear that for Felix, the change was going to be sexual. And for many of us, it's a challenge to discipline the sexual part of our being. And so we say, you know what? I can handle a lot of this, but not that. That seems like too much. And so very often, we'll just opt out of that. It is astonishing to me that we live in a culture where you can go on YouTube and find just anybody who has put something on YouTube and said, you know what, you should try this. I tried this and it was great. And we will change huge portions of our life based on some random stranger on the internet. And we will change our diet, and we will change our exercise plan, and we'll change our finances, and we'll change our personality because some random stranger suggested it. But when the God of heaven says, this behavior is unacceptable, we balk and we say, no thanks, God. You don't know how hard that is. There's something wrong there. What will I have to change? Is still the question for us. It is the nitty-gritty of the gospel. I love talking to people about the gospel, and I love seeing them put the pieces together, and there is usually a moment. Sometimes Sarah and I are both involved, and we've seen this firsthand. There is a moment where someone begins to put it together and say, that's what that's going to mean. Maybe they take the word repent and they say, so what does repentance mean? And we talk through it and they say something like, oh, this means I can't keep living with my boyfriend. Oh. And you never know what you're going to get from that point forward. Some people will react like Felix and say, can we change the topic? Can we talk about this later? And sometimes they'll explore it, and sometimes they have the courage to say, yes, I want this. But that is nitty-gritty moments, brothers and sisters. That's the gospel. That's the challenge. And the question is, when we are faced with that, it's easy to talk about other people and what they need to change. I think we're all experts in that. But when it's me, and it's my life, and it's my attitude, and it's my words, and it's my relationship with the opposite sex, and it's my willingness to forgive other people, what about then? And I also want to suggest to you that's not something that only happens when we first receive or don't receive the gospel. It's something that we have an ongoing responsibility to ask. What am I going to need to change if I want to keep following Jesus? The gospel will mean change for you. I don't know the specifics of that change for you. I can tell you for me, it's meant that I've had to change and face that nature that I told you about a minute ago, where I want to please people more than I want to please God. I've had to relearn the way I treat and view the opposite sex. I've had to face my pride, which is an ongoing thing I'm facing. I've had to come to terms with my goals in life and learn to be content being faithful to God and not accomplishing everything in the world I might dream of. I've had to leave behind ways of dishonesty that I've practiced for most of my life. I've had to learn how to let go of really deep hurts that others have done to me. And every one of those is an ongoing work and an ongoing change that the Lord is working in me. There are more things that need to change for me, but what I cannot do is say no to a God who knows better than me and calls me to account. Righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come is a message for every one of us. And the question is, am I willing to do what God calls me to do? Because there is a standard, and there are things I must limit myself about, and someday I will stand before God, and the books will be open, and my life will be naked before Him for Him to make judgment of me. Don't be a Felix. Don't reject God's will for you because of what people think or what it might cost you or what you might have to change. So my question for you this morning is, where do you stand in the eyes of our God? I hope that as we thought through these things, you're thinking about your life and you're thinking about the challenge each one of those represents for you. And so I just call on you, is it time to lay down the burdens of sin and pushing back against God and say, I want to do God's will now. I want to make changes to follow Him now. I want to submit to Jesus now. And so this moment is one in which we sing a song to encourage you to take that step toward Him. And we encourage that if we can help you to deal with some issue in your life, come and let us know about that. Or if you're ready to give your life to the Lord and be baptized into Christ and have your sins washed away, come, let us help you do that. Let this be a moment where you decide, I'm going to say yes to Jesus. Don't